Hi, thank you for being here. You have been researching digital vigilantism for a while now, which entails cancel culture. And I think it's important to clarify maybe in the beginning, what is cancel culture? A lot of times that I'm talking with people, some of them think this is just pure harassment. And I feel like cancel culture is something a little bit different, is pursuing some kind of social justice. How would you define it?
I would agree with you that it's, for the most part, a matter of pursuing some sort of justice. And of course, in a way that comes at the expense of someone's career. So the idea of what happened to like someone like Harvey Weinstein, where people were sort of at a certain point saying, we refuse to work with this person, that is an instance of someone being canceled. So I think it's, you see the very obvious examples sort of at the highest levels of like Hollywood or other institutions. But I would argue that it also happens with people who aren't as prominent or aren't as famous. So people who might be, let's say, authors in very niche fields, where rather than having like millions of people see their movies, it's more of like hundreds of people reading their books, still getting a following, still being scrutinized, being called out for things which we may agree upon as being problematic or objectionable. But then, yeah, as a result, people saying, well, like, we refuse to support this person. So I think you have like the very obvious cases where like everybody or almost everybody turns their back on like a sexual predator or someone else. But we also see examples where it's a bit contested. And I think the concerns that you said other people might raise in terms of harassment, I think harassment can take a lot of shapes and sort of sizes and forms. But I think there's also sometimes an overlap between a case of cancellation that also has some instances of harassment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering it was also online. Did you find out about cancel culture?
Yeah. So as you said, I've been focusing on digital vigilantism. And before that, I mean, for almost even more than 15 years now, like the way people watch over each other through digital media. So cancel culture to me seems like the most recent version of this. And so a lot of these cases, of course, we see online, either through our own social media, but often through like news reports. It's always interesting the role that the press plays. The exact term cancel culture, I think I first heard it from one of my master's students in a course on this topic. So at the time, I was familiar with call-out culture, which is a bit different. Mm-hmm. And of course, seeing celebrities be denounced, so people like Harvey Weinstein or
R. Kelly, maybe?
Yeah, R. Kelly, but also Rihanna's boyfriend at the Chris Brown?
Chris Brown.
Yeah, and again, those were cases where like people sort of turned their back on celebrities before Me Too and before cancel culture were like terms that were in sort of, you know, household names in a sense. So it's, to me, this term seems fairly new, but you can look at the way that people have used digital media or media more generally to kind of direct attention to wrongs and to sort of denounce people, and you see a lengthy history.
Mm-hmm. The term may be more or less new, but this has been happening for a long time.
Yeah,
already.
Maybe not to the same degree, or like it hasn't become such like a crystallized sort of like thing that we recognize and we give it a name. Before this, I think it was just more like individual cases of people being sort of doing wrong. But with, I mean, especially with celebrities, there's always been this sort of halo effect where they can get away with things that somehow, you know, for other people wouldn't be excusable in terms of like sexual harassment or other types of crimes or just kind of saying the wrong thing. So I think we see this sort of, you know, especially in a post Me Too era where, you know, people are no longer as willing to sort of tolerate things which, you know, were sort of like the worst kept secrets in terms of like people being sexual predators or people just kind of being irresponsible in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Also, I feel like the post Me Too also allowed for these movements to first believe the victims, mm-hmm. instead of having these really long waiting times until the justice, the actual system, to do something.
Definitely. And I think with vigilantism, even pre-digital, just people sort of taking justice in their own hands, one of the deciding factors is this idea that people see that they can't trust, you know, law enforcement, or that they're ineffective or they're slow or they're unresponsive. So the idea of taking justice in one's own hand is often predicated by that. And I think in terms of the way that a lot of different justice systems have failed victims of sexual harassment or sexual assault, that sort of leads one to sort of pursue these avenues, which, as you point out, can lead to, I mean, a certain type of justice, not what we would find in courts, but we can discuss that. But it certainly has a much more immediate impact, and it mm-hmm. sort of brings visible things which have typically been sort of swept under the rug or sort of excused away in very sort of private manners.
Mm-hmm. I know that you mentioned before the websites like Turtle Boy, mm-hmm. so where people are now denunciating normal people or not so, you know, with such media power. How do you feel like cancel culture is now transforming it? Because I feel it's been really changing from its original denunciatory culture.
Yeah. And a lot of these types of websites or initiatives, I think, also predate cancel culture in some way, so that you would have like certain subcommunities that might wash over each other or kind of police their boundaries in terms of what's acceptable or what's not. You will have websites where just within a certain region, people, you know, either for enjoyment or for profit or for political gain will sort of, you know, identify and kind of direct attention and harassment to specific, you know, ideological opponents or whatever. So mm-hmm. these kinds of things have been going on for a while. And the internet, as it's grown, has facilitated that in terms of becoming more accessible, more localized. So I think what we sometimes see is people who have already sort of made their careers on kind of harassing other people or on sort of provoking outrage or kind of whipping people into some sort of like angry frenzy, especially looking at sort of areas of the internet or of the world like the alt-right, they're then able to sometimes use some of this language in a way that might legitimate some of the things that they do. So there's people sort of in the alt-right who have used a lot of the language of like Me Too to go after people who have said problematic things in public or on their Twitter accounts, but, you know, selectively targeting their own ideological opponents. So like using this in a very instrumental way where, you know, we might debate whether or not these people being targeted deserve to be sort of called out. In a lot of cases they do, but it's a sort of selective, like, why are we focusing on these people as opposed to other people? So like serving someone else's purpose.
Mm-hmm, for sure. This idea of fake woke culture. Mm-hmm. So how, yeah, they use the same strategies and same features,
yeah.
Which also makes me think that the platforms have such a big role on what they allow or which features they have. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the platforms will have a role to decrease this, or they don't are not very interested because it's profitable for them?
I think if it crosses certain thresholds in terms of hate speech or in terms of, I mean, being very disproportionate or like leading to someone being severely harmed, at least most platforms will make a public spectacle out of being concerned about this. So what happened in India with like the WhatsApp lynchings in terms of people circulating rumors about people who are being abusive or kidnapping cows, and then, you know, someone would come into this town and they're a stranger and they're, you know, then they get targeted and they get killed. From what I've seen, WhatsApp has taken steps, you know, through newspaper editorials and through these public statements to say like, we're trying to fix this. But most of that is much more about preserving their public image as opposed to really reworking the platform. I think maybe I'm being a bit too cynical here, but the idea of soliciting engagement and getting people into sort of an active frenzy on these platforms is sort of, you know, what pays the bills and what keeps them sort of profitable. So I can imagine that they would rather that this activity is happening through socially progressive means, you know, people coming together to like, you know, rescue kittens or to combat certain sort of harms or whatever. But I mean, if they were really concerned with preventing these kinds of, you know, forms of harassment or disproportionate forms of justice, I think they would have intervened a lot sooner. Yeah. And, you know, whether we're talking about Facebook or Twitter or any other platform, like, you still have these moments where you look and you see, you know, certain groups are kind of active or certain people are still sort of denouncing or naming and shaming people. And you think like, oh, this is still happening. That's kind of interesting. It's been like, you know, 4 or 5 years now. And yeah.
Still happening. But should they try to prevent these movements? In the beginning, we were talking how maybe this is a way for the users to make themselves heard.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a thing that users would like to see also?
It's hard to say because in this conversation, we are, as I understand, talking about some cases where, you know, people are using this language and these practices just to harm like someone they don't like. But the same practices, the same rhetorics can be used to really address harms, which there might be no other way to really bring it to light. So as easy as it is for me to say the platform should do more, I could also see that if they were to implement certain measures, especially like wide-ranging measures, like zero tolerance policies on denunciations or on certain forms of like identifying certain issues, that would also in practice be political repression or silencing of free speech. And so, yeah, on the one hand, I think platforms can't simply be negligent,
mm-hmm.
But maybe it should be done in a more, and I'm just thinking out loud here, but maybe more of a reactive process where if people bring complaints to them, they should have the staff and the support to sort of process that. And of course, in a way where those people who are handling those issues are well treated as well. So it's not just someone who's paid minimum wage to kind of like siphon through like thousands and thousands of like forms of hate speech, for like, you know, 60 hours a week or something, like recognize the labor that those people are doing. But I think having people appointed who know the local cultures in these global platforms to really sort of assess like how to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets a bit tricky too, because then you have on the one hand, the sort of local cultural contexts, you know, what someone in the Netherlands would sort of know about Dutch culture, to say like, what is just and what's not, and where should we sort of step in and what are legitimate grievances, which again, who's in a position to really assert that, even if we know what in our hearts is right, but sort of reconciling that local knowledge with a platform that, you know, is meant to sort of serve hundreds of countries at once. It has to be done at that sort of global level, but that would require, you know, so many people sort of brought in that, yeah, it becomes really messy.
Also because a lot of things are so platform specific. Mm-hmm. So it's so specific that maybe someone that is not very familiar with these platforms can't understand what's happening or the full scope of it.
Exactly. And that's the thing that gets really tricky is certain cases will cut across several platforms, but really understanding like the language and the skills that are involved with one platform and the ways in which that can be quite harmful. So, I mean, for someone like a freelance journalist who sort of cultivates like an online presence on Twitter, and then, you know, the way that they might be targeted on that in a way that might, for someone who's just like a casual Twitter user, you know, they wouldn't really see the harm or it would be inconsequential. But for them, it's like, okay, you know, my career has been sunk now, or like I can't, every time I try to sort of present myself in this public space, which is linked to my work, people are going to see like the worst things I've ever tweeted, or they're going to see these replies that keep coming up where people remind me of the worst thing I've ever tweeted. Like mm-hmm. it's, yeah, the differences in interfaces and platforms matters.
Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of people have been trying to also to migrate to other platforms, maybe ones that can be more restricted. I was looking into a platform that is fairly new, it's still being developed, but the code of conduct is so strict.
Mm-hmm.
They don't allow, well, some things that it's already being discussed, like hate speech or bullying or harassment, mm-hmm. but also crystals. So talking about this pseudoscience.
Oh, okay, like the healing crystals.
Healing crystals mm-hmm. or other forms of
like multi-level marketing or
everything. So mm-hmm. it's really, you really need to follow their policies to create this safe place.
Which is interesting because, I mean, to me, like the discussions of crystals, That often sort of is a package deal, like the person who might share the thing about crystals and then share the link about chemtrails and then about like the Soros Foundation. And it's like, okay, like we're slipping into like, I don't know, anti-Semitism or, mm-hmm. or like anti-immigrant sentiment. But in and of itself, to draw the line at the crystals is, I've never heard of that before. That's, yeah.
It's a long list, and codes of conducts and these policies are being built more heavily. Mm-hmm. And the reasons why they are building these platforms are also because of call-out culture. So to escape from all these.
Which is interesting because I imagine in practice, they would never be able to really restrict that without curtailing some forms of free speech. Free speech can be extended too far and can be abused, but that also sets an interesting precedent in terms of, I'm guessing what they're trying to say ultimately is like, we are not like the public forum. This is not the agora. This is not where like anybody can come and say anything. That's always been a bit of a project that's had its limitations pre-digital technology, certainly on the internet. And like, this is just a place where people can talk about certain things and have the freedom to be, you know, to not be harassed or to not sort of expect like, you know, the laundry list of items that you're pointing out that they don't want. And for everybody who feels excluded by that, like that's not their responsibility, which mm-hmm. is quite different from like the language that the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Googles and everyone else has sort of taken, where it's like everybody's more or less welcome. And in fact, you're compelled to speak. You're always kind of prompted like, hey, what's on your mind? What are you thinking? What are your friends thinking? Mm-hmm. So that's, yeah, I'd be curious to see how that develops over time. Because I mean, pre-Facebook and during Facebook's growth and everything else, there's always been alternatives. I think there was one like 10 years ago, like N-1 or I'm forgetting the name now. But I mean, there was so many of these types of ones that, you know, gather a bit of a following. And then, I mean, we don't hear from them anymore. And maybe that means actually they're doing rather well. They get like a nice sort of cohesive user base, people who get along with each other. And like, it's not appearing in the news. And maybe that's actually a good thing, yeah. So I've been a Facebook user since 2006, and I eventually jumped over to Instagram. I still use Facebook passively, but for me, it was the idea that like there was too many people on Facebook. And even though now they're all owned by Facebook, that idea of just kind of starting over with like a smaller circle of friends, not expanding it as much, it just kind of provided like a nice alternative in a sense that now these are serving different functions. But I think that need to kind of have some sort of alternative will always be desirable at that sort of individual level, but also at this collective level that we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, we were talking about how these people can feel politically active. And on the other side, we also were mentioning how it can be a form of entertainment almost if it's consuming mm-hmm. the people, like, for example, Big Brother or Keeping Up with the Kardashians even. Can it be entertainment and also political active movement?
Yeah, I think it's always a mix of the two. And I imagine that there are some people who do it strictly for the political motivation or because they want to make the world a better place. But I would assume that for most people, at least part of their motivation is this idea that like sort of hate consuming something. I really like the idea that you mentioned Big Brother because I got into this broad topic of people watching and judging and scrutinizing people during my master's thesis. And my master's thesis was on the reality TV show Big Brother. Yeah. And the idea of like people saying certain things on like the TV show, and then people would obsessively watch the live feeds on the internet and catch them in a lie and then talk about them, denounce them, and then they get kicked out of the house. I think, again, that's a separate weird universe of like a certain subgenre of reality TV. But I think that a lot of those same principles apply here. And especially on Twitter, where it's like someone will tweet like, oh, like, you know, I can't believe that such and such politician did this. And then it's almost like a sport where you would go through that person's tweets and like find something that directly contradicts their denunciation. So this idea of like just kind of finding the holes and or the inconsistencies or the hypocrisy in people's, you know, digital records. It's definitely something that's kind of definitely appeared and grown a lot through cancel culture, but has also just become, I think, this sort of almost like digital media sport, like just something that anybody can pick up.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever engage with these practices of actually trying to tweet with this hashtag or about canceling someone, or do you prefer to stay on the margins?
I prefer to stay on the margins. I'm more of like someone who would like lurk online, so kind of observing what's going on and I guess getting engaged if need be, but for the most part, I'm kind of still very ambivalent about certain cases and stuff, or just kind of seeing how it develops. And especially when it's something where if I'm not familiar with like the cultural context or something, I think it's, as a digital media researcher, like you have to kind of find a balance between knowing the platforms, knowing the culture, knowing what's going on, but also, I mean, if someone was a bit more hands-on than I would be, I think they would still be able to do excellent research. But yeah, I think there haven't been a lot of cases where like I felt that my voice would be very important. And by the time that I would sort of come across those cases, like they've already sort of blown up in a sense. It's like, well, what am I going to do by piling on? Mm-hmm. But it's not so much based on my political ambivalence, but more even in other contexts. Like I don't really contribute to Facebook. I don't really contribute to Twitter. Like I use them more, to kind of stay in touch with people like through like private messaging. So the idea of like having a public persona on these platforms and sort of constantly tweeting what's on my mind, like even before cancel culture, independent of these cases, like that's never been my thing.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of lurking is perfect. I really like it. Mm-hmm. As the you don't need to be shouting on the internet just like the others to be... you can be listening or lurking, and this can be a... It's needed.
Yeah.
And that's how I actually wanted to do the podcast, to listen to these things and give attention. Mm-hmm. So I also...
Yeah, to me, that seems like a great position to be in because it's like if you're listening, you're the one who's sort of like actually able to give an account of what actually happened. Often the ones who are sort of talking over each other walk away from those encounters and like have a very skewed idea of what happened. So I see a lot of value in the way you describe that.
Thank you. Do you have anything else you'd like to discuss, or do you think it's important to mention?
I'm really curious about just this idea of cancel culture and like linking this up with the idea of like the court of public opinion, like because we're talking about justice seeking, but what is the outcome, like in terms of, you know, if you use the language of shaming, like the distinction between rehabilitative shaming, like, you know, reconciling the wrong things that someone did and like they're able to kind of step away and like become sort of an improved person, or exclusionary shaming, where it's like, you know, we cut you off. And if we as like all of society or just a specific subgroup, like those distinctions matter. So I think we're really good at like kicking off these kinds of events, kicking off these movements, but where it's meant to end and like, you know, who is sort of allowed to be in public again and like what's acceptable and what's not, like that's where I think you see a lot of the disagreement and like where like we're still kind of coming to terms with like what is going on here. And likewise, like notions of proportionality, like, I mean, in legal systems, they struggle to sort of achieve these balances in terms of like the punishment fitting the crime and like what's right and what's wrong. And like, we're just a bunch of people on the internet. Like, you know, there's sort of this hive mind thing going on, but in terms of like trying to aim for like, okay, this person suffered enough, let's all stop now. Like that never happens. So I think what we've talked about right now is really focused on that sort of kicking off moment, like where something potentially grows and goes viral. But what is the outcome? What is the desired sort of like, you know, what are we working for here? And I feel like that's, you know, none of us are sort of professionals. We're not law enforcement officers. We're not judges. We're not lawyers. So like we're in one sense absolved of those issues, but we're still starting something that has to have an ending. And like, and again, whatever we kind of agree on as being right or wrong in any single case doesn't set the tone for everything else, because everybody who has been sort of denounced online, like has arrived there for different reasons. Sometimes because they're like longstanding sexual predators and horrible people. In other cases, it's like, well, you know, it was a woman who dared to speak up and like now is being sort of like, suffering like the, online pylons and all sorts of harassment and stuff. So, but often the discussions about call out culture and cancel culture tend to kind of treat everyone who's in sort of the crosshairs as being the same. So I think there's still a lot to kind of consider, both in terms of like, thinking about this academically, but also like as, citizens using digital media, or like, how are we going to teach our children to like, not just kind of protect their own privacy and protect their own reputations, but not to bring too much harm to other people who might have done something wrong. Like, Also the idea of, to borrow from John Ronson, this idea that we're potentially walking around with the worst thing we've ever done or the worst thing we've ever tweeted. It's kind of hovering above our heads, or like anytime someone Googles your name, like they'll find like, oh, like this is like your lowest moment. Like, are we actually working towards that? Is that liberating if all of our sort of skeletons are out of the closet? Is it just going to like reproduce existing inequalities where like if you're privileged enough, you can still kind of scrub what's said about you online where everyone else suffers the consequences? There's a lot of things I think we still need to explore.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. As usual, I don't have a good motivational quote to end this. It's more stuff to think about it.
Yeah, it's the kind of topics that, we can't sort of wrap it up very neatly in terms of, it's ongoing. So ongoing. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, really.
You're very welcome. Thank you.